Welcome to this episode of the Level Design Podcast. In this episode, we turn the focus back on our very own Jonathan Wilson from Hangar 13. Welcome, dear listeners, to another fun-packed and sunny episode of the Level Design Podcast. I am indeed Mark Drew, and today I'm joined by my regular co-host, Rob McLachlan from the Chinese Room. Hello, Rob. How are things going down in Brighton?
Things are great, thank you very much. Life is good.
Epic. We're also joined by game designer extraordinaire Valentina Chrysostomou. How's the weather out there in sunny Scotland? Is it sunny?
Hi, everybody. Yeah, it is sunny today, and I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
And as I said at the beginning of the show, we're putting the spotlight back onto our regular host, Jonathan Wilson.
It's very strange to be on the other side of the conversation this time.
Yeah, we're going to get a virtual spotlight, or you're going to have to go and get a lamp in your house and just point it at your face. Going, tell us the truth, Jonathan. What's it like working at Hangar 13? Well, no, actually, what is it like working at Hangar 13? You've been there like what, a year?
I joined Hangar 13 a year ago today. I joined, my first day was the 20th of May last year.
Right.
Living in Brighton and working for the company for just over a year. We finally announced the Mafia 1 remake yesterday, so I've basically been tinkering away at that for the last year, which has been quite fun to be lost in the 1930s for a year.
It's better than being lost in the 2020s, exactly, I've got to say. But developed last year, I remember nearly all of Brighton was bedecked in Hangar 13. Hangers, in fact, because they're hanging from the streetlights and everything else, with a massive recruitment drive.
Yeah, they had a big presence there. I think they've had a big presence for the last 2 years, but I just joined 4 weeks-ish before develop. We did do another recruitment push there, which is quite good to have the stand. I think they had developers going down to the Hangar 13 booth to have discussions. So we had a rotation of programmers being there to speak to programmers, designers for designers, QA and production and stuff, just to have the relevant people giving the relevant advice, which was quite cool.
I seem to remember you had a big party on the pier as well.
They did. I almost missed that actually, because I'd gone on holiday and I think I got back really late on the first day of develop. So that was a mad dash to at least show my face for a couple of hours.
You've just joined this company, you've set up this whole party in the place that you live. Oh, you missed it, did you?
I made it back just in time.
If listeners have been here from the start, they know that our first episode was literally a panel at Res, essentially. It was the Mysteries of Level Design panel at Res 2019. You know, it feels like it was a lot longer than that. And you were working at Res that year. You weren't just exhibiting, were you?
So for Res 2019, I was working for Pocket Money Games at the time, and I'd been working with them on a bunch of different their game projects, and it was the first game show they'd done. I helped them get a bunch of demos ready together, went through a bunch of the contacts I had at Res for work I'd done in the past, and then got them set up with a booth where they showcased 4 games. So I showcased that year, did a bunch of portfolio reviews, and then jumped on the panel with you guys, which was super fun. So it was a very busy show.
So you're working for Hangar 13, a great company, and as you say, you're doing Mafia, but what are you doing? Are you a level designer there, senior level designer? What's your actual title there?
So I'm a level designer at Hangar 13, and we've kind of spoke about this on the podcast in the past. The definition of a designer can change from studio to studio. Obviously, you'll always have game designer, and in some instances, you'll have level designers or you'll have mission designers and things like that. So in Hangar 13, I've noticed since joining, there is a mix, and the roles are a little bit different, but there's a lot of crossover between a mission designer and a level designer. The level designer will obviously be more happily involved in layouts and give more feedback on that, whereas a mission designer will probably be more focused on the logic and making sure everything works together. The definition I've seen since being there, it's more focused towards the mission design side, which makes sense because the locations are pretty set. They've created a city, and the city's kind of quite believable, and it's obviously based on real world things, so you're not just making these locations from scratch to make your gameplay super pretty.
I mean, that makes sense. So it's like a level designer for a city. I mean, we've talked to other city builders. That's a different kettle of fish. You know, you're not talking about architecture, you're talking urban planning, right?
Yeah, you basically got to, like, I think we touched on it when we did Valentina's episode, but you'll find the locations within the walls and then map them to your mission, right? So like you'll know the points that you're going to go to, you'll know what's going to take place at these set locations.
And your involvement is to like say what happens in these set locations. I mean, I played Mafia 3 quite recently. There's the ones in New Orleans, I think.
Yeah.
They've got a very good reputation amongst the players, haven't they? And the level of excitement about seeing the remastered edition, I think that really just pays testament to how fondly people remember it, just as a kind of pioneering open world game, really.
Do you think there's a big pressure now for Hangar 13 to release a great definitive edition for Mafia?
I think the pressure's kind of always been there. And I think it's partly the risk with this being a remake on new technology and rebuilt from the ground up. Obviously, there's the expectations of modern games, so like modern day gamers and what they expect. And granted, a lot of the audience here are going to never have played a Mafia before, almost certainly never have necessarily played Mafia 1.
Mm.
But there is a diehard fan base out there for Mafia 1 that love that game, and we've got to find a way to kind of honour both. So I think we have something to offer for both of those audiences, like overall. So like if you've only played Mafia 3 and you've never experienced 2 or 1, then you'll still feel, at least with the game systems and gameplay, at home with this. And then some of the systems and detail that are in it are going to appeal more to the hardcore like audience who are really into that more kind of systemic simulation like stuff. So getting a ticket, getting arrested and things like that, that you kind of were in the original. It's kind of trying to keep that as a balancing act, or at least what I found.
That sounds pretty awesome, to be honest.
I mean, I'm no game publicist or anything like that, but it's like you want new players, right? I mean, what I've noticed with remakes is like just make a good game. You've already got like the basis of the previous game. You might have to pay, and any lip service that you pay backwards. I'm thinking of Resident Evil 2, for example, a brilliant game, right? That feels really modern, but it pays lip service to the original, but it can stand by itself. Does that make sense? It's like, I know it's based on the
problem. Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of people have to start to look at remakes of, especially given the amount of them we've had recently. Like, you brought up Resident Evil 2, it tapped into all the nostalgia and stuff that we had because of the location and the characters. There's a bit of controversy around Final Fantasy VII Remake. I won't go too far into it, like, to avoid spoilers, but the game is a remake to an extent, but there is evidence of Square Enix taking liberties with it to give themselves more creative freedom, kind of like what you're suggesting there. Like you said, if you want it to be a good game, you only have to honour so much of what the original was. And you kind of see that in a lot of remakes. Like, it's modernising an old game will require change. You can't just carbon copy everything.
Would you say Mafia is a remake or a definitive edition? It's kind of like there's a thin line between those two, I think.
I would say a remake. It's like I say, it's being built from the ground up with new systems. So like it's not like we've not just up-res textures. Like if you've seen the original Mafia, you couldn't do that. It's weird. It's kind of like way too old. I remember just after I joined trying to play the original, like for research and stuff and references. And I hadn't seen these gameplay mechanics in such a long time. It was like peak and pop gameplay. So like you couldn't take cover, right? We didn't have cover shooters back then. So it was a case of edging around a corner to shoot at enemies to keep yourself from being shot. So it was kind of like eye-opening and kind of a reminder of how far we've come from like the early 2000s to like where we are now by expectations of games as well.
I mean, I was looking at Silent Hill 2 from some of the videos and stuff and trying to see like how would you remake that? You know, like I think the remake would have to be completely different. It'd be like inspired by, because it's a difficult job that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to bring up Silent Hill actually, because they did bring out effectively remakes that they brought out onto PC and later PlayStation console.
I think it was just an HD like edition of that.
Exactly. And they did the thing that that I think Jonathan rightly called out as something that you shouldn't attempt to do, which is basically they attempted to up-res textures and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was actually, I think most people agreed that it was a bit of a visual downgrade.
Yeah, I actually played it, and the fog was, it wasn't really great because the fog in the original one, you had a certain purpose of hiding the environment around you. And now I think the HD one just, I don't know, it kind of removed that feeling. And you could see a lot of the buildings and the area around you, and it didn't give that claustrophobic feeling, or if a monster is hiding in the fog, or it just didn't look as great. It didn't serve the exact same purpose.
I think with Silent Hill, though, like the original, obviously the fog, it was used to mask technical constraints, right? It was used to hide. Hide everything, but it also created that like claustrophobic atmosphere that Valentina mentions. So if they tried, they put that on a higher end system than what they had originally, instantly they don't need to mask as much anymore. So suddenly they start to reveal more. You lose the claustrophobic nature, and like you said, the visuals might have looked a bit downgraded anyway because of all this changeover. But it's the change in pipelines. It'll be the change in rendering technology from what they had then to this as well. And they think and just doing it the same way they did before, but it works differently. So you can't just do that. You have to refactor something to get it to work on a new system.
There's even a project in which they, the community, I say, like waving my hands in the air, have been up-resing it and fixing bugs. And for example, the bug of the fog. Because it's a bug, right? If it now destroys the intention of the game or the perceived intention of it, they've been fixing all of that kind of stuff, and you go through all the different things that you have to do to install it.
Yeah, the one final thing, perhaps on that, when we were making Silent Hill Origins, we were making it on a more technically capable system to an extent, and with the benefit of hindsight in terms of gameplay mechanics. And it was definitely a point of discussion and argument within the team over how much we should take that core Silent Hill gameplay of restricted camera angles and almost awkward controls, in that you feel at risk almost all the time because it is awkward to turn around, it is awkward to hit, it is awkward to land a hit, and you may not even see the enemy correctly on screen. Because you have these fixed cameras sort of spline cameras that exist within the environment and don't necessarily take into account of the kind of actions of the player. So you don't have generally the over-shoulder camera, which is almost obligatory in most third-person games nowadays. So I think in the end we decided that we would cue closely to the sort of Silent Hill atmosphere.
It worked really well. I really liked Origins, to be honest. I know a lot of people didn't, but I really liked it because it was so similar to Silent Hill 2 and 3, even though it came out years later. I'm like, yeah, this is what I want. This is what I wanted.
There are some really interesting stories about production of that. Maybe we can come into that.
We will be talking to you in a future episode. We shall focus the light upon thee soon enough. But today,
I have a question for Jonathan. Was there anything that you, in the remake, that you found potentially harder than what they accomplished in the original? I'm thinking of perhaps in terms of making lots of assets to a much higher standard. Was that a struggle, for example, to have so many character models, or was it a challenge in any other way, or any gameplay mechanics that actually were easier to accomplish in the previous version?
So I guess in the previous version, you like expectations were definitely a lot lower back then, like for how, like you're talking about the population of scenes, right? Like the amount of NPCs you would see in an area.
Well, I don't think the expectations were that low. I remember reading in Edge, and at the time that was the cutting edge. It was like, oh my God, they've made a whole city.
Yeah.
So I guess in 2002, like based off articles like that, they kind of set the bar, they created the city, they did things like that. But you fast forward to 2020, we're kind of used to seeing populated cities and things like that now, right? So the one thing that we definitely decided to focus on is the era-specific stuff. It's the one thing Hanger's been known for. The same with New Orleans in Mafia 3, like recreating that world and the setting and the kind of world design and the vibe. So that goes into it, and it does usually take a lot of people, and you end up with high density scenes, which, like anyone that's worked in game development, you'll start off just populating the scene, creating the atmosphere and the tone that you want, which, obviously, I can't go into super specifics, one, for spoilers, and obviously there's not that much being revealed. But if you've played the original, you know there's a few locations or a few missions that have high populations or high densities. Like, for instance, one that stands out from the original to contention for difficulty was the race mission that exists in this game. It follows the same story, so the all the major beats you're going to still kind of encounter. So that was kind of like, for at least from what I see, the test was how do we build live crowds in the kind of game. And I think, if I remember rightly, that would probably be the most populated one, which becomes your benchmark in development. And then you build everything kind of off the assumptions of that. And that's kind of where I got all my, I guess, research for stuff I worked on in the game as well. That was my reference point.
It's interesting having to work on that level of getting something that has got a history to it, has got an expectation to it, but you're trying to like hit the next bar, you right? You want to fill the pages of Edge with new stuff, right?
One of the things I found, but especially when I first joined the company and I found out I'd be working on the kind of remake, it kind of like made me question, how well do I know this game? And there's going to be fans out there that know this better than me, right? Like, there's going to be diehard fans that have lived and breathed this for years and still do. And then all we can do is, obviously, in the remake, is obviously we do our due diligence. We play the game, we play the original. And I know the story like the back of my hand. I know that city. And it's just all about learning it. So when we do go in as designers into the city and we're building our missions, we kind of know the locations and like what they're good for, what they're good to be used for. And kind of we start to learn our way around the city just so we can plot stuff out better. And so, yeah, like there is that kind of like fear of expectations existing because of what the original was, and then expectations of wanting something new. And that's where you get a divisive audience. But that's, I think, the case if you ask anyone that's worked on a remake, then you're always going to have that. You're going to want to obviously recapture what you had in the original, but you're also going to want to step one up yourself at the same time.
Do you think it's harder working on a remake than the sequel or a prequel or something?
It's easier because you've kind of got a roadmap. It's not necessarily easier to get the quality of the content you want. Like, that's always going to take time because of the way you want to execute it and you want to deliver on it. But at least you know in a remake, because you're usually following the same story, you know all the major beats you have to hit. You've just got to kind of fill each beat in between each beat with interesting content.
So do you think a remake can never deviate from the beats? For example, let's say someone wanted to remake Mass Effect 3. People had different opinions about the ending. So if the studio came over and said, like, we're remaking that, do fans, would they like that ending? Would they like a different ending? Would they like that kind of change in a remake?
I think for one, play Final Fantasy VII Remake and then we can have this discussion again at another point. But in regards to a remake, it's kind of within the creative control of the development team, right? Obviously, you do want to honor them, but if you believe that something or offering the player the opportunity can lead to a better outcome. And obviously the Mass Effect 3 example is kind of perfect because they did release patches and reworks to that to kind of try and course correct an ending after, like, post-launch. And I think it was some DLC that gave you the fuller picture. So you can do stuff like that, but if you don't do what Mass Effect did and do the DLC correction, and then years later you end up remaking it, creatively, there's nothing stopping you from putting a deviation at a plot point that allows the player to go off. Because obviously Mass Effect is all about choice. So like you could put more emphasis on the choices and give players access to something they never had in the original if they play a certain way. But the original ending will probably still be there.
That's a really interesting thing about games compared to every other medium, is that one, okay, maybe not films because you get director's cuts, but you can do this course correction, you can put patches, you can improve like that bad effect, not the Lucas way, you know, for Star Wars. I'm still scarred by that, those bad special effects. But, you know, you can course correct years later. I mean, that's a perfect example. You put patches in, you're like, hey, there was bad animation, right? We didn't have the schedule to do it. Obviously, if there's money in it, right, for smaller teams, but
well, apparently the Cats film had a patch. They brought out several versions of the Cats film where they patched in different animations and visuals.
Really?
That was really short after it came out as well. There wasn't much time between its original release and the re-release.
Exactly. There's one of the original cuts. The hands hadn't been done, so all the cats had human hands. It was only on the second.
That kind of sounds like a bug, though, right? But when we talk about changing an ending, that's kind of a creative direction.
Yeah. So and who is to say, Exactly.
I like how we don't even like finishing each other's sentences. We already know what we're talking about. Yes. Why would you change a creative direction? Is the previous version the original, or is the new version just what it was meant to be?
I think that's a difficult question for nowadays, because you'd say, well, the original version is the one that went down on celluloid and got printed and we made it a 1,000 copies that we sent to cinemas for movies, right? But now they've got digital distribution,
yeah,
even
exactly.
In movie theaters, right? There isn't a van that turns up with the 3 reels per film. So you can get a, you know, like, hey, just download this new MP4 video. I don't know, whatever they send movies as.
Bit of a weird example, but this kind of like course correction or rebooting stuff happens a lot in anime series. One of them, I can never pronounce its name right, but Evangelion, I think, is like that's been a series which obviously tells a story, and then it was kind of re-released again in like 3 parts, so like longer movies that tells the same story but in different ways, and that was their way of fixing it, I guess, but it is still same characters, kind of like same plot, same world, same crisis, but they kind of tell it in this more, I would say, concise way. But I think if you add all the movies up, it probably expands to the same length as what the series was. But like that's an example of, I guess, using the same creative license and same story, but as a retelling. And you've done that because you want this to become your new canon, but it is still that same plot.
It's really fascinating that the number of would people agree that the movies are media properties and IPs with the strongest fandom and the kind of deepest lore to an extent are the most susceptible to this kind of revisionism? And is it a good thing or not?
I don't know. I think it depends on because how do you measure all those biggest fandoms and stuff like that? Because you might have big vocal fandoms or small vocal fandoms compared to massive fandoms like...
The voice of the fandom can be extremely loud and extremely...
Especially
persistent.
In the recent years.
Exactly. And like, as was brought up earlier, Mass Effect 3, you know, the changing of the ending there. It's a very interesting thing to me that a company would, well, publicly say, yeah, we got it wrong and we're going to bring out a new ending with the one that you all want.
Yeah, what doesn't mean we got it wrong is that it's not a bug, it's something that you have decided. Do you not believe enough in it to remove it just because people spoke up? I mean, I actually like the idea that people got so excited for it. It's better to get a reaction from your audience rather than them not caring about it.
I think it could lead to, and obviously it happened a few years ago, but it could lead to a dangerous like precedent though, if people are being super vocal online and complaining about an ending, and then they manage to get this ending changed, where does it stop? Like, where do people believe that it has to stop? Oh, I don't like this ending. If we shout and scream at it enough, then okay, we might do it.
Well, in a game, you could just add it, right? Like, I wanted my dog ending for certain horror movies and horror games, and I got my dog, my space dog that's controlling all the action. Ending.
I remember that ending.
Yeah, that's the strength of games. So you can
that's
add
the strength of games. You can add multiple endings, and you can have each character ending their game a different way based on their choices. But there are definitely many games where it is a linear story, and what happens at the end happens. And again, with Last of Us is another franchise where already certain leaks have come out where people are, a section of the audience are unhappy with the decisions that Naughty Dog's made.
And in that case, I think it's very unfair, mainly because, hey, you haven't seen it. You're taking a segment out of a game or a topic or a subject on it and going like, I'm angry at it. It's like, we've seen enough stories that if I sell it to you badly or just do a bad trailer, oh my god, don't get me started on trailers though, but you could get like angry about it, and especially on Twitter, because that's where you go out to shout and be angry.
That's why I think there should be a line between developers and, well, the audience, because developers are the people who will iterate on something for 5-6 years, and they know the changes. There's no original edition for them. Everything keeps changing. But for the audience, they should judge once they get the final edition, if you want to call it that, play it, and then you should judge it. You can't just see an image or a video and be like, oh, no, everything's bad, everything's horrible, I won't play this game, I'll unsubscribe, buy, delete. It's not fair to the developers, especially, yes, with the recent release of The Last of Us 2, obviously, and that's the one I'm talking about. So the vocal people online, there might be just a minority. We don't know that.
Yeah, and it probably is. We'll have to have another episode of when The Last of Us comes out and have a good whinge about that. But so you've been working on Mafia, Jonathan, but you also worked on another different IP, which was Superhot.
Shortly after I left CourtSync, I kind of went self-employed for a while, but mainly started working with Pocket Money Games, and that's where the large portion of my contracts came through from. And they were contracted to work on the port to the Quest, like, just around about the same time I was starting, which was super interesting. I'd already been working on Quest for a while when I'd been working with CourtSync, so I kind of knew how that hardware worked. I knew what was possible, how the movement, the scale of freedom and stuff you were getting. So obviously ideas run rampant. If you've played Superhot, you want to try all this new cool stuff. But at the end of the day, in its essence, the game still has to be the same. But what we found was when we were actually working on it, we don't really have to add that much. Just having that greater sense of freedom and being able to move and actually pop out from behind cover and stuff like that was actually super freeing to begin with. And we experimented with a few different ideas, like the hacker room and stuff. We did that, and I remember for Oculus Kinect 5, there was a demo put together for that show for Quest specifically. Well, obviously on a show floor you have a massive space, so you can really kind of show off the freedom the Quest could do, and you could actually walk around the corridor and you'd walk into the room, the hacker room, and pull the headset on, and then the game would start. And that was kind of a trade show specific thing, but it was like something nice to be able to put in the kind of game as well. And then most of my time was kind of spent more on like technical side of helping optimize, rethinking like movement systems and stuff like that as well. Because we had, if you've played Superhot, you're usually going in VR, you're usually going from point to point. So you kind of jump into mini arenas sort of thing. So we obviously had to factor in or think about systems that would account for where you were last facing. So when you do teleport, you're kind of rotated in the right direction, and we are recentering. We had to try and be recentering you all the time so you didn't walk into a wall. So it was like that kind of stuff.
Okay, right.
I think that was one of the fascinating things of working in VR. You were always second guessing all these decisions, especially for locomotion stuff. The Quest was the last thing I kind of worked with in it, but it was also where it showed me it got to the point of, this is super cool. I'm not tethered. I don't have any wires. I have complete freedom, and I have my hands, because the Quest controllers are very similar to the touch controllers on the Rift. And it was kind of, this is the freedom we've kind of always wanted. So going from working on a Gear VR to an Oculus Go, where you had a little remote or you could touch the side of your head, to now having complete freedom, no wires, and actual hands in VR, it kind of showed what is possible. And I think Half-Life Alyx is kind of the first example of, if you go all in on a game and try to really throw all the game design, the mechanics and all that logic at it and view it as, this is just a game, the platform is kind of embrace it, instead of just trying to translate what works in a video game into VR, you kind of wanted to build an experience that is taking advantage of all these different things.
That's the truth for most platforms, I would say, maybe, because the real successful games tend to be the ones that like lean into it. You know, they're like, okay, right, this is what we can do. Let's really do this. Half-Life Alyx, like that's an amazing, that how the hands work when you're touching things. By the way, if someone hasn't played, I should explain what it is. Is if you push a door open, your hand will lean on it, your VR hand, and the fingers will pull back and look like they're
actually on the surface.
You know, they'll be physical. And you could say, oh, well, you know, if you hadn't me describing it, you might go, there's cognitive dissonance there because your actual fingers not being pulled back and stuff, but it doesn't matter. It works, right? I don't know how to explain it. It just works. Fine. You accept it. So if you lean into those kind of mechanics, it's really cool. The catching things in Half-Life Alyx? You know, like you know, you pull something towards you and you catch it, and it just.
Yeah,
works.
I think Half-Life Alyx is kind of that accumulation of all these ideas that have been iterated on since VR first came about. Is it the index that it's kind of primarily built for to take advantage of? Obviously, it works with a normal Vive and stuff like that, but they've kind of tinkered away with this for a long time. Like, they've been invested in VR since the beginning. Like, releasing the Vive was like the first step, and then this is probably something they tinkered with for a while and then realized we need the index to create the best possible experience to actually deliver this. And like you said, whenever you're working in VR, you're always thinking of that. What is going to cause the disconnect between the player and the actual world they're in? And it usually is putting your hand on a surface and then like not really having a disconnect. So usually most games will give you a ghost hand, so like the player's hand or the character's hand in the game will stay on the surface and you'll see a silhouetted version continuing through, just so there's something like that. And there's loads of systems that have been tried, there's loads of been experimented with, but usually the most immersion breaking thing in a VR experience is be very mindful of what you're putting in front of the player, because as soon as they can't pick up or knock over or touch any of this stuff, that's the immersion broken. So it's like, if you don't want them to touch anything, get it out of the way. Anything within my reachable space, I should be able to manipulate somehow. Otherwise, it should be out of my actual reach area.
Yeah. I wonder if adding some sort of sensor to the controller, so when your virtual hand touches something, you can have like a vibration or some sort of sensor that you could feel it on your actual hand. Because I know some psychology experiments where, I remember one, I don't remember what it was called, where they hit someone's hand behind their back and they sat down in a way with a dummy hand right next to them that looked like theirs, and they touched that hand with a feather, and for some reason our brains think that this is our hand, so it tickled them even though it wasn't, something like that. I don't remember exactly. So our brains can be tricked. It's just that we just have to find the ways.
You mentioned haptics, and that's a big one for a lot of feedback in even normal game controllers and stuff now. Like the next generation, a lot of the stuff that's being talked about for rumble is more haptic based.
Mm-hmm.
The rumble in your Switch Joy-Cons is kind of haptic based as well. And most mobile phones, or at least most iPhones, they've used haptics for a while for notifications and stuff. And it is just because you have more control over the sensation of the vibration that it gives you. So it's not just like a generic one. Like when you've got a DualShock 3 or 2, it's a generic rumble. You can turn from 0% up to 100. Whereas you can actually, with haptics, you can calibrate a lot more. So you'll find a lot more like VR controllers and stuff like that will use it. Mm-hmm. So they can, like you said, trick the brain.
Sounds like a good idea, yeah.
So that was at REST, right? But before that, you were at CoatSync, which did a whole bunch of games, didn't they?
Yeah.
That was like what's the aspect?
So that was CoatSync's like first like foray into VR. So it's basically a VR puzzle game. You have telekinetic powers, you can control objects with your mind, and you solve an assortment of puzzles. So it kind of has a very simple lock and key mechanic. Of usually you take an object, you have to get object into receiver. But at the time in the first one, it was all based in an office because you couldn't, in VR, locomotion made people sick, so you couldn't really move around. So it was kind of seen as a aptitude test, which was then kind of sold by having like kind of witty narrators. So you think of like, take influence from Portal and the narrator you've got in that, you kind of see people come along talking to you over the radio. So when they got funding for the sequel, that's kind of how the company was able to grow. And that's kind of how I got hired. Ironically, I got hired to work on Shoe, which worked out great for me because it's the project that I saw beforehand and wanted to work on. And it allowed me to do level design, which out of uni, that's kind of what I really wanted to focus on. But obviously being a small indie company, you just wear multiple hats or many hats and jump between different projects. I got to do a little bit of work on Esper 2 while also working on Shoe as well. And that was interesting because that was when I first got to see designing puzzles around VR and designing around those limitations. So like playing the first one, like they'd already built and kind of like how they built upon that as VR was progressing slightly was quite interesting. Because like I said, with the first one, it was primarily on the Gear VR, which all you had was a touchpad on the side of your head. So you could only really tap, pick up, tap, put down. But then you have the complete head movement. So the idea of making you feel like Charles Xavier from X-Men, using telekinetic powers to move objects around, was actually quite cool. And you could actually get, you could get quite a lot out of that. And then you put like a narrative layer over the top, and that's how the kind of more came through in the sequel, because you went to, we got like a basic movement system in because systems were working in VR better. So we, the game was able to expand. But that started a great relationship between Quartz Inc. and Oculus, and kind of led to them doing a lot of VR titles.
One of the ways that I think I met you was through BAFTA.
Yeah, I think you joined BAFTA Crew in 2019. So that was actually my third year in BAFTA Crew.
Ooh, look at you.
But I think with BAFTA Crew, it was a weird initiative that I didn't really know much about until I met up with Mel, who sadly no longer works for BAFTA. But yeah, I remember I met up with her at Develop one year to talk about and actually learn a bit more about what the initiative was. Obviously, I wasn't living in London, so I knew I wasn't going to be able to take a great deal of advantage of all the events they did at the time. But it did give me access to this like kind of network / community of people, which whenever I went to events, I'd go to the meetups and kind of meet them. And it did lead to like a lot of panel discussions, a lot of like talks with people, and that's kind of how I learn and how I develop. Like most of the time throughout my career, it's always by just having those discussions with other people, seeing other people's talks and attending events. So putting you in a room or in a group or like a network full of all these different developers from different backgrounds, different companies and different studios was kind of ideal. So that's why I kept applying every year. And then obviously I applied again in 2019 because I'd moved down to Brighton to take advantage of the events more that happened in London, but then COVID happened.
Oh, well.
But it does make it a lot easier. I can just jump on the train, go into London and actually attend some of these things and stuff like that. But they have started spreading more further afield, because like I have seen events happen up and down the country now as well, which is quite nice.
And amongst all of that, you've also become a STEM ambassador.
Yes, so STEM ambassador was mainly because I applied to become a VGA, which is a video game ambassador. And it's kind of like you go in to schools, you go into colleges and stuff like that, and it's like you giving up some of your time voluntarily to go and talk to people who don't necessarily see games as a career prospect or a path. Because even when I was in school and stuff like that, there wasn't anything about games. And you knew games were made, but there was no educational route at the time telling you how to get there. And even then, it's still college or university level before you'll actually hear or learn anything about it. And Mel was another great ambassador for this sort of stuff, and I helped her with some workshops. But talking with primary schools about how you can introduce the concept of game design or game development even within primary schools is kind of where we have to get to at this point. Colleges and universities is fine, but they are already kind of set on the ways to know it. So being a STEM ambassador gives me the clearance to be allowed to go into schools and talk to students, and whether it's about careers advice or even talk to teachers about how they can rework the curriculum, just to help people realize earlier on how many jobs there are in games, how varied the field actually is, and sure, it is a potential career path from a younger age rather than waiting until later on.
Which is really important, because there's so many skills within game development that there's so many paths in either the art or the programming or even management or you know, all those skills. It's like great to let people know that they're there. And it's not just magic fairies making games and they're coming out of them with a unicorn poop as a factory. I don't know how games are made.
Nobody knows.
Literally nobody knows.
Well, yeah, we really need more people coming into the industry. It's really, really important to keep, especially in these days of very high content games where you need huge content creation teams. And that will only really increase, really. I think it's really necessary we keep getting people into games.
Because, as you say, sometimes the bar's been set in the quality of the games that need to be come out. I mean, going back to the beginning of the podcast, so the bar that happens now is that, like, hey, yeah, we want to build a city. It has to have everything, including, you know, like, chewing gum on the table.
Yeah.
I can pick up in VR.
And eat it.
And eat it, exactly.
Taste it, yeah. And just to sort of rub the salt into the wounds, you get things like the Unreal 5 video coming out.
I mean,
extremely seems like an extremely heavy content pipeline, but maybe that'll be okay.
That demo is insane. And if it is running on a PS5 like this year, and at this point I believe them, but it's like one thing to bear in mind and take with a pinch of salt, this was built by Epic engineers working literally probably within the hardware of the PS5 to get this to work. So it's not like an out-of-the-box demo sort of thing. So for teams, it'll take a while to get there, but it's, I don't think we'll be there at launch of next gen, but it'll hopefully be there very soon.
My main problem with those tech demos is that they never show the team that made that. So how many people worked on that 15-minute demo, and what exactly did they do to get that to run? Is it running? Like, is the frame rate okay? What hacks did they do to get that? Will we be able to, a Naughty Dog or Hangar 13, will they be able to make a 30-hour game that will run that perfectly?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, but I think the issue is now not going to be will it be able to run. It's going to be like, how the hell are you going to deliver that?
Yeah, all of that, that's what I mean.
That whole scene, the whole demo was what, maybe 100 gig for maybe, like, I'm just going by the polygon count, right, and a few AK textures. Like, there were billions of polygons, as they were telling me, all the triangles, they just used all the triangles ever.
There's so many triangles, you don't even see the triangles.
The pixel now. having said that, sorry, I was going to say, like, you're going to have increased fidelity of stuff, but what that demo actually, I think, showed was a reduction in pipeline. So, like, do you now need a whole team of lodders that would get your ZBrush sculpt and make the 15 different, I don't know, four versions of LOD.
Yeah, that's also what I meant. How many people will you need to make one piece of the mountain? Where are you going to find these people?
Exactly. And what are the tools going to be like for doing that? I'm really interested to see what the new editor tools look like.
It's easy to make a tech demo. It's harder to make a whole game that changes on the spot all the time. If you need 300 people, you need to give them the proper tools and everything.
If it delivers on what they showed and kind of what they said about this demo, then I like kind of what Mark said about the lodders or people whose job it is to optimize this or do the variants of all these high-end models, their job will change, because in theory that won't necessarily be as necessary as it was before. One of the exciting parts is, if this is true, it lowers the bar for smaller development teams to reach this level of quality, because they don't have to hire hundreds and hundreds of people to create that amount of quality and actually get it to run. But that remains to be seen until we see developers using it out of the box. But in theory, if it works like that, then the quality bar of an indie studio or even like a double A studio will increase just naturally if they're using Unreal. Because of that, they can almost reach the new levels. But then, is the quality bar set by the AAA studios? Is it that demo we saw, or is it higher than that? And that's probably what's going to blur the lines for a while.
And also, one thing that I've experienced is, Last of Us is a very good example, because I remember it came out on the PlayStation 3, right? And then I actually could only buy it, because I never had a PlayStation 3, on the PlayStation 4. And they'd up-res it, they made magic, but it was at the end of the PlayStation 3, right? It was like really pushing that platform really to the edge, right? I mean, it's
a known platform,
By then, it's a known platform. And if they're delivering these visuals right now, the beginning of the platform, which is an unknown platform, and yes, of course, like, you had the big brains in there. Imagine towards 3 years into the platform.
It's definitely going to be a very exciting time. And I mean, like, you mentioning the graphic fidelity of like The Last of Us, and obviously it did come out when the PS3 was like defined, it was non-platform. The best example I had of that was watching the Uncharted series. So seeing Uncharted 1, like Drake's Fortune, and what that looked like on the PS3 in 2007 versus what The Last of Us looked like when it came out. Like, you can, and that's, but that's still the same hardware. That's still the same hardware that built Uncharted 1. same tech built The Last of Us. The engine would have changed and their pipelines, but it's like you said, once a system becomes established, we just get more and more out of that thing. So kind of having these, it's why consoles benefit from the fact of having this lockbox, whereas PCs change all the time. You can upgrade your PC, you can get a graphics card, but as a developer, you can't build exclusively for the best graphics card in the world, because you'll have a very small audience. But if you're building for a console or a fixed spec, then you can just keep getting more out of that.
Wait, I can't build for the 2080 Ti?
I mean, you can for a smaller audience, yeah. But...
Jonathan, I've got one question for you. So you're a STEM ambassador, you're part of BAFTA, you've been at REST, you showcase demos, you're on panels, you're on podcasts, you're everywhere. So how important do you think it is for a beginner game developer to be involved in the gaming community? Or are you doing the things you're doing because you like it and it's not really necessary for a game developer to get involved as much? What do you think?
It's a little bit of both. So like my first bit of work experience came from networking, and it was just a happen chance of being at a networking event that was set up and having a conversation with someone, talking about games, talking about what each of us do. And then that led to going to see what they were actually working on, and I got an internship during uni for the final year doing that. So I do believe being involved in the community is important. I don't feel you need to go to every event. If anything, just be involved in your local community, and by that I mean know who's on your doorsteps and know what game studios are in your area, things like that, and just be aware. And the reason I do a lot of the stuff I do, especially the STEM ambassador side of it and the careers advice, whether it be portfolio reviews and stuff, is because I remember how hard it was when I was at uni to try and get access to all this stuff, and it wasn't really readily available. And it's kind of a lot of stuff I would have helped me back then. This is a way for me to kind of give back a little bit, and at least try and help, like I said before, the next generation of developers. And for the most part, help people identify what they want to do, because the game industry is so varied. A lot of people think they know what they want to do, but it's not actually what they want to do when they get into games, because it's actually completely different to what they think it is. I wouldn't say it's super necessary. Like, for instance, your portfolio is going to speak higher than whatever events and stuff you attend. But if you go to events and stuff, you can show people your portfolio. Like, so kind of like hand in hand, it kind of goes out there. So I think it's a benefit, but I know it's not for everyone. Like, say, as much as I do all this stuff and I do go to all these events, it is draining. It is tiring. I do enjoy it. I've made loads of friends in the industry through companies I've worked at, through events I've been to. And I've made friends inside and outside of the industry by doing the stuff that I've done.
Thank you so much for actually putting yourself forward to be interviewed like this.
It won't happen again anytime soon. I'm kidding.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Dear listeners, if you want to follow us, I guess you could follow us on Twitter. It's a pretty good place to find us. We put out a nice bit of content. Obviously, you shouldn't follow us in public, because at the moment that's a bit of a dangerous thing. So just Twitter is the best place. Or subscribe, obviously, on Spotify and iTunes and all your podcatchers out there. Some people seem to be following us on Other, which is in the category of the podcatchers. If you want to tweet me, if there's something I've said that's wrong and you want to correct me, Twitter's a very good place to do that, because that's exactly what Twitter is for, to right people's wrongs. You can follow me at Mark Drew. Jonathan, if people want to right the wrongs that you have said...
There's probably a lot of them, so... But yeah, if you want to catch up with me, you can reach out to me on Twitter as well at omni/92.
Rob, there's nothing wrong. You've said nothing wrong. But if people want to praise you for your correctness, what should they go for?
It's my one correct hour of words in my lifetime. Maybe, probably not. You can find me on Twitter at RM McLachlan.
And Valentina, if people want to praise your awesome skills and brilliant questions, where should they do that?
They can find me also on Twitter at Valentina CHRYS. That's half my surname.
And listeners, thank you very much for joining us in this episode. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
The Level Design Podcast has been a Command Studio production. Our Editor is Matthew Lever, and this episode has been produced by Bridie Rose.